You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Ted Riederer. Ted, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Ted, let's talk about what you're working on now. What's happening in your studio or life?
Well, my wife Rose and I just had a baby, so we're working on that. He came a little early, so we're just trying to fatten him up and get him ready to come home. And as far as the artwork's concerned, I'm getting ready for the Open Spaces Biennial in Kansas City, which is curated by Dan Cameron. And I'll be mounting the 8th version of this ongoing conceptual art project I do called Never Records, where I, to make a long story short, basically open an art installation in the shape of a record store and then cut vinyl records for free for the community. Cut 2 copies, one for me and one for them, and I give them their digital file that they can sort of, in the spirit of open source, release on their own and sell. And in the past 8 years, I've done this now 7 times internationally and have over 500 recordings, everything from science lectures to hip-hop to my most recent installation was in Amman, Jordan, where I had a record shop in the old city of Amman, and I cut pretty much everyone on Trump's travel ban, Syrian refugees, Iraqis, Egyptians, even some Sudanese refugees. That was a really special one. So I'm really thrilled to take it to Middle America and see what happens and how I can kind of contribute, provide an ear for people that might not have ears to paying attention to what they have to say, sing, or recite.
So that's pretty cool. Let's talk a little bit about that. Of course, I know the project and I've read about it, and I'm a big fan of it. Really, when you set up this installation, talk about what you're going to prepare for. You're going to set up a record shop at this installation. What's in that record shop? Are there past recordings in there? What's in there?
Yeah, so this is sort of the anti-Spotify or anti-iTunes. I try to, I really believe in inscrutability, and I try to make it hard to listen to the recordings. So what I do is the only way to hear the records, aside from a radio show that I have, is to come to the shop. And I've tried various clever ways of installing the shop, but I don't know, we could talk about this a little bit. I have a big beef with a lot of, for lack of a better word, relational artists in art, where they're doing something in the spirit of community, but they make the installation or exhibit sort of exclusive by using this wonderful post-conceptual language of exclusion. So, for example, someone like Hirshhorn, who does a reading room and a housing project, that doesn't really work for me. It's problematic. Or one of my favorite artists, Rikrit Taravanija, when he makes lunch in the gallery, people still have to be comfortable enough to cross the threshold into the gallery, which I think a lot of your average people who aren't familiar with the rules and the language of the galleries and museums are a little bit intimidated to cross that threshold. So a while back in the initial stages of Never Records, I decided that I wasn't going to make it to art world. And so sometimes people walk in and out and thinking it's a record store and have no idea that it's an art project. And it's a little problematic because, you know, my 2 most dreaded words in the English language are experiential marketing. And you have these companies like Levi's and other companies who will do like a pop-up shop. And
right.
So sometimes I feel like I'm treading on dangerous ground where Never Records sort of exists in this nebulous world of like pop-up shops and such, but it's really important to me that people just from the street feel comfortable enough to come in. So for Kansas City, I have a couple of cool things planned. From the installation standpoint, I'm going to do a large life-size recreation of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album cover, which will sort of surround the stage, but I will use my own roster or mythology. So I just got a great photo from a photographer named Jeanette Beckman of Joe Strummer. So he'll be in my Sgt. Pepper's cover, and Walt Whitman and some other people from my camp.
Which is cool, which is an homage, like the Beatles did. It's an homage to all the people that have influenced you.
Exactly. So, you know, I try to make it look and feel like your average record store, but then I like to do one or two sort of conceptual tweaks that might be visually interesting for people.
Well, the conceptual sort of tweak also when people or issue when people come into the shop, if they think it's a record shop, is nothing is for sale and the records that they're used to aren't there. It's more like a listening shop, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think of it as like a reading room or a social site. Again, it's really a performance piece. This is sort of hard for me and people to wrap their brain around. I've been asked a couple of times by biennials or galleries if they can get someone else to do the recordings if I'm not able to stay for the duration of the exhibition. And my response is, no, that's like asking Marina Abramović to have someone sit in for her in the lobby of MoMA, you know, sitting across from the table. Because what happens is I have, you know, the sessions last for 3 hours, and over the course of 3 hours, not only do we have, you know, really fun and wonderful conversations. I mean, I've always loved recording sound my entire life. I've been doing it since I was 12. But I show people their sound waves under a microscope, and that synesthetic sort of demonstration of visualizing sound really puts the brakes on time for a second and sort of re-enchants the idea of, you know, what's possible in our world. And then I also talk about sort of these existential questions about instruments, and there's like a whole sort of lecture that goes along with every participant. So in that sense, it's you know, more of a performance piece, and I sometimes.
But it's not so much as a lecture; it's a conversation, right? You're
yeah, that's
with
important.
Each participant.
I don't want to be like, you know, didactic and preachy about
it. But I also mean that it's also more one-on-one or one-to-three. It's not like you give a lecture every day in the shop at 5 p.m.
No. So it's every person gets their own special treatment. For sure, and
you're recording directly to vinyl, or how does that machinery work?
It depends on what the participant wants. I have gone straight to vinyl, but generally I record to, you know, a digital analog interface into a program called Pro Tools, and then I will produce it a little bit, mix it a little bit. It just depends on what people want. I've done straight to vinyl, or I've done more production where I've sort of offered my own, you know, like producer advice and done overdubs, and it just depends.
But that's also if they're making music or singing, right?
Yeah, so like I'll have, you know, if someone wants to add extra harmonies or another guitar part, I can do that. If someone wants to try something experimental, I'm always up for that. So a lot of times, because I can cut vinyl in real time, we can record something to vinyl and then manipulate it and record that again. So it gets really fun, and sometimes it gets really deep into this rabbit hole of vinyl. In Jordan, we were across the street from a mosque, and the call to prayer constantly got on record, so we were trying different things. There's a Armenian instrument called the duduk, which is kind of like a reeded clarinet, and the musician needs a drone note to sort of play off against. And I found that if I could did a tight loop of the call to prayer, I could make this really great drone note for the duduk. So stuff like that's super fun, and it depends on, you know, what city I'm in. There's always something amazing to play around with.
Well, you're also doing something kind of like the guys who did it in the 60s or 50s, but like a music ethnologist, right? Or if that's the term, where you're going around and you're also collecting sounds and voices of people who aren't heard, whose voices don't go to tape or vinyl.
Yeah, so I'm definitely an heir to this great tradition of ethnomusicology. I actually minored in that at Tufts. I kind of forgot that I did, but so someone like Alan Lomax or...
That's what I was thinking of, right.
Or Moses Ash of Folk Dance Recording. But I think what I'm trying to do is a little bit different. They're more like collectors, song collectors, and I'm more interested in this fleeting, ephemeral moment when I get to the fellowship of like kind of collaborating with someone and showing them this magical process. Because if you look at a groove of a record under a microscope, it's a wave, it's a sound wave. So if we had, say, a tone generator that could generate perfect tones, you would actually see perfectly round waves of, in different frequencies. So the idea that, and then the other interesting thing is that without amplification, if we yell into the cutter head while it's cutting to vinyl, without any electricity, it will capture that sound to vinyl. So to me, it's just this alchemical, seismic, beautiful, you know, thing, the stuff of heartbeats and fingerprints. And when I share that with people, this sense of wonder is, you know, infectious. And I always think that artists are kind of soldiers of time, and that we're trying to sort of get people to pause. And in the tumult of our culture and the oversaturation of media and social media and all this stuff, you can't ask for much from people, but if I could get someone to just take a pause for like a second or two, then I think that's been a successful art piece.
Hmm. I like that. And so in preparing for this biennial, is there any other elements that you're taking into account because of its location, or anything particularly different in this iteration as opposed to the past?
It's interesting. I try to kind of keep a real open mind, but I am doing a lot of research about Kansas City right now, and it's a really interesting place. The racial divide there has really existed and persisted since the end of the Civil War, and there's this incredible... I think in that region, over 1,000 battles were fought in the Civil War, these border wars between Kansas and Missouri, which were basically a war of abolitionists versus pro-slavery forces. And when there's a riot in, like, Ferguson, it's not something new. This has been going on for, you know, over a century. And going back to the early 20th century, there were these, you know, lynchings and riots and back and forth. It's just this endless cycle. So I think that was really eye-opening to me. I think whites have this tendency to sort of think that there was a break in history during the civil rights movement, but I think that while it may have put the brakes on some of or ameliorated some of the problems for a short while, that they still persist. So, but how does like sort of someone coming from an academic approach address that? And I tend to not try to influence the timbre and tone of the project. I tend to just see what happens, because honestly, when you give this gift for free of workshopping recordings with people, great stuff happens no matter where you are. So I'm just kind of hoping that Nova Records will work its magic like it did in Northern Ireland and like it did in Jordan. I mean, I was terrified going to Jordan. I didn't know if it would work because I had never done it in an Arab country before. But it worked beautifully. In fact, some of the best recordings were just people who are walking down the street and happened into the shop. For example, this young kind of shy guy was poking around the shop and asked if he could do a record, and I said, of course. And it turns out that he was an Iraqi classically trained singer. But after the second part of the Iraq conflict, he was forced to flee and was now working as a civil servant in Jordan and not singing at all. And so he came in and sang, and it was really quite a beautiful, moving moment. And then he continued to hang out at the shop for the rest of the time that I was there. And on the last day, he said, you know, you really rekindled my love for singing, and, you know, thank you. So that's, I think, just by providing this service, this whatever you want to call it, that it is what it is. It's an interesting way of making art, and I've had debates with the artist Michelle Grabner about it, because, you know, she has a couple of galleries that she runs, like one in a carriage house behind her house. And she calls it being a platformist and doesn't necessarily think that that's being an artist. But I sort of think that that's a good thing, to be a platformist, and that it can be a form of art. I don't know. I don't know what your thoughts on that would be.
Oh, that's interesting. So, because I've interviewed her too, but she's a platformist. Doing what she did as a she says what she's doing is being a platformist, creating galleries, curating them.
With regard
them.
To her gallery, yeah, her carriage house gallery, the Suburban.
Right, well. The Suburban and the Poorhouse, but also, yeah. And she says what you're doing is also, you're a platformist, as opposed
right.
to it being social practice.
Exactly.
Right?
And I think it's all mixed up in there. That's my feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good thing to talk about. I have a lot of, you know, I mean, the art that I've done is collaborative, and it was always talked about as. So I have a lot to say about all that. We could discuss that, but the performance work I've done has been things like hugs and foot washings and non-visible wounds and bandaging them, and as well as other interactive things, which all fall under the rubric of social practice, and I think you're right. You know, I couldn't agree with you more in the beginning, where there's this kind of social practice, you're engaging the public, and then at the same time, there's some kind of very exclusive environment created, which is the opposite of what you're trying to do.
So
for me, that's a very interesting question, and, you know, and especially when you mentioned Hirschhorn and Rick Ritter of Venezia. You know, these are people I don't mind talking about, however you want to discuss what they're doing, because I think you're right. I think there is a kind of elitism almost to certain kinds of this interview series. For me, I've never talked about as social practice. I didn't want people to initially feel that they were part of my art project. I was doing this really for its own, I don't know, intrinsic value. I like talking to people, and I know it's turned into an archive and has another kind of value. But I was recently asked by a teacher at SVA to give a talk on interviews as social practice. So, okay, it can be that,
right.
But don't want to deny that it's that. But I think that there is this kind of, this murky area that's confusing about what that means and can seem sort of elitist. I mean, when you mentioned Rick Ritter of Venezia, I thought about a show he had in New York, and I don't know if you remember this, but I just kind of love this. It was at Gavin Brown, and it was when Gavin Brown had those big garage spaces on Greenwich
yeah.
Street, and maybe you know this already, And it was a show of Rick Ritchie of Indonesia, and I don't remember there being food there, but there was stuff you could take or whatever. And there was one artist who saw that there was a car parked in there with the keys in it, and she assumed that was part of it. So she got into the car and backed it up. You heard about that. But, you know, that to me was really interesting. I talked to her afterwards and everything, and I thought, you know, that was so cool in a way. And, of course, everyone was also so pissed off. Gavin Brown was pissed off and felt like, you know, you should have known. But it intentionally blurs those boundaries, right? I mean, that's part of it. Is this art or isn't this art? And where does it end? So I'm not sure where I'm going with this thought, but it all ties into this kind of complicated notion of what it means to be, to even use terms like experiential marketing, social practice.
Yeah. So I came out of grad school, as you probably know, from SVA in 2006, where we were in this like hyper commercial environment where, you know, the 2005, I guess it was, PS Greater New York had over 30 Columbia MFAs in it. And our open studios was literally like the minor leagues, like galleries were coming and taking artists from the open studios. And we were all just like hyperly stimulated about this idea of getting a dealer and all this stuff. And I benefited from it. I had a great project show at Nicole Klagsbrunn, and I had some stuff at PS1, and then I got to go over to Berlin to do this big show for Goff and Rosenthal, and I was super like obsessed and focused about the market and commercial art gallery system. But what happens is, as you live your life, what's become more of a priority for me is constructing a beautiful life. So in the sense that Never Records has taken me to all these countries, this art project or whatever you want to call it, practice, has taken me, you know, to Northern Ireland, where I am now like sort of an adopted son of Derry, and I can go, I've been back repeatedly, and I have this community there that, you know, appreciates the work I've done. I I don't have a dealer. I have there's no real commercial action. Every now and again I sell something, but just this past March, this curatorial group called Dogma Central in Ecuador invited me to perform in Pujolí in the Andes, and I performed in an abandoned cockfight arena, which was like one of a once-in-a-lifetime experience, like greater production value than any Matthew Barney piece. And then I performed my Drums and Roses piece outside of a colonial church on Palm Sunday as Mass came out, and everybody's surrounding me holding the palms, and I'm playing the drums with roses. And it was just one of the most beautiful experiences that I could ever hope to have. And all of this, you know, I sound a little bit like a romantic in the sense that I really, really, truly believe, and you can look at the past decade of my work, that if you put yourself out there as sort of a true and sincere artist, it's like a beacon to other like-minded artists and curators, and they find you and you find them, and you get to have these incredible experiences. You know, I also taught art in Bangladesh and Dhaka and Chittagong, and that was like, you know, this is all in the past 10 years, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. And somehow, sorry, I'm digressing, but I was also sort of, you know, I'm one of those artists that works. I envy the artist that doesn't and somehow can pay their rent and spend more time in the studio. So I spun my wheels for about 9 years working in Chelsea, and I worked for some amazing galleries, but they were sort of scions of commercialism, and I was really, you know, becoming disenchanted with the whole endeavor about trying to make and sell art. And then I lucked into this job that I've had for the past 3 years, where I'm the director of a not-for-profit gallery in East Village called HAL Happening, an Arturo Vader project. And it is like a social practice project for me because we do affordable healthcare workshops, affordable housing workshops. We run an emergency phone line with the Actors Fund for any creative in the East Village who's in crisis. We did 135 events last year, all these different happenings and panels and dance performances, concerts. And then, we do 8 annual exhibitions, and it's become sort of a wonderful way for me to pay my rent, But I feel like I found that job because, basically, through love, because it's named after a friend of mine, Arturo Vega, that passed away in 2013. So, I feel like I'm on this other side of New York where I stopped trying to be kind of a careerist and just was following, more pure ideals of like joy and fellowship and love. And I've ended up having this kind of really enriched experience now. And I think that that's the trick to being a successful artist, is where your practice is a way of living that keeps you warm at night, you know what I mean? As opposed to just to selling stuff or getting the next exhibition and the next show together. So anyway, sorry, I just preached. But.
No, I'm glad you said that. I wanted to let you go on that, and maybe just circle back to, because I think I didn't answer your question when I started going on about social practice and Rick Ritter of Amnesia. You said Michelle Grabner said you were a platformist, and what did I think about that? And to me, that sounds like another term that's sort of meaningless, that we've got to sort of figure out what it does mean before we kind of engage in that. You know what I mean? I don't really have a strong feeling for or against, are you a platformist or am I a platformist? I feel like it's more in line with what you're just saying. You're an artist involved in a number of activities. Would your being a director of a nonprofit space make you a platformist? I think it makes you a director of a nonprofit space, but as an artist, you bring a different sensibility to it, just as I do with the interviews. But platformist, I mean, you can tell me what you think. That sounds, I don't know. I don't want to use any derogatory terms, but that sounds kind of odd to me.
Well, I think she's really brilliant, and all of our conversations have been sort of self-reflexive in a way. So I think she's trying to figure it out as much as I am, She famously said to me once, "Reader, I don't think you're ever going to be a full-time artist." But it wasn't in a pejorative sense. It was a stay gold pony boy kind of thing. Like, don't get on this treadmill of like art fairs and commercial gallery exhibitions. And she has always been incredibly sort of, she encourages Never Records, and she encourages my more out there performance pieces. In fact, she had me perform Drums and Roses in a survey show of hers in Milwaukee. I don't know where it was, but that's what I like about our relationship, is when she's bringing up this weird word, she's really just trying to wrap her brain around, what it means and what she's doing. Because I think, if you look at the Suburban catalog, it's got this amazing roster of artists and some amazing work that they've done over the past decade that, it's almost like you can't imagine it not existing. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And I got to go out to the Poor Farm, which I think is like Marfa in the Wisconsin woods.
Right.
It's just gorgeous and such a beautiful idea to take this Edwardian workhouse and, make it into something beautiful and positive. So, like, I have just the most respect. But I think as an artist, I don't know if you are an object maker, but like when I'm doing a painting, I am the happiest. I'm like my new son when he's nursing. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Yeah, this relaxation washes over me, and it's like my version of transcendental meditation. But so when I have a studio visit and I'm really excited to show paintings, but everybody wants to talk about Never Records, it's a little bit of a disappointment because, you know, there is something sort of, well, I always like talking about Never Records, obviously, but I think that that's where the conflict for artists comes in, is this idea of like, we've been sort of inbred to feel like authorship is this really important part of making art, where like that signature or your brand or your visual style is like, should be identifiable with you. And if you're making work that's more ambiguous, you know, the way we've been inbred is it doesn't feel quite right. Like, I'm often, you know, just treated like an engineer, or when I do Drums and Roses, like a stand-in, because I'll stand by the drummer and hand them roses. And, you know, sometimes that makes me uncomfortable. Sometimes it bruises my ego a little bit, but I also kind of like existing in this I don't know what you would call it, like a liminal state between the artist and the person on, you know, on stage or whatever. I like kind of being on the sideline. You know, I don't know if that's confusing or.
No, that's clear. I mean, it also makes me feel like we should do a second interview, just about your paintings.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, we should.
So let's do that. But also, when you talked about the Drums and Roses performance in different places, is that distinct from you're generating sounds, but you're also cutting records from people during the Drums and Roses performance?
No. That's just a separate piece altogether.
So that's a sound piece. You're really creating kind of a concert, an ambient atmosphere.
Yeah, it's a sound piece, and it's an installation. So I just get a drummer to play the drums with 10 dozen roses. Sometimes I'll do it, but I really like having someone that's never done it before try it, because then you get this comedy of someone who's been handed, you know, not their instrument and expected to play. And you can really watch the musicians struggling. Some get it, some don't. Some triumph and make it sound amazing. I had a Moby's drummer, this guy Joe Goretti, does, when he does it, it just sounds like an amazing drummer playing. But the pedals explode and it becomes kind of a visual music. And then once the performance is over, you have this crime scene of drums covered in rose petals, which kind of can exist on its own as an installation. And I almost like that side of it better, because someone will happen upon the scene and be like, wow, what did that sound like, or what did that look like? So
right.
It's a nice piece in the sense that it plays around with all of these themes and motifs that I address in my work about sort of trying to hear visuals, or, you know, see sound.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. And let's do the interview eventually. We'll talk about that after we're off the record on this. But I'd like to talk about your paintings. And I also want to ask you the last question here of this interview, which is, what are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious.
Okay, so I'm reading right now, as part of my Kansas City research, a book called Racism in Kansas City. And I don't have the book in front of me. I don't know the author's name, but it's that's why I was able to kind of talk about the border wars earlier. So it's I'm right now in about the 1930s, starting in, you know, the formation of the territory. And yeah, it's amazing. I'm also reading a book about jazz in Kansas City, because Charlie Parker comes from Kansas City and has this rich tradition of jazz. So, yeah, that's what I'm reading right now.
Well, great. Well, I wish you great luck with a biennial. I'm sure it'll turn out, you know, wonderful. And Ted, thanks for talking with me today. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.